Numbers chapter 21. When the Canaanite king of Arad, who lived in the Negev, heard that Israel was coming along the road to Atarim, he attacked the Israelites and captured some of them. Then Israel made this vow to the Lord: "If you will deliver these people into our hands, we will totally destroy their cities." The Lord listened to Israel's plea and gave the Canaanites over to them. They completely destroyed them and their towns, so the place was named Hormah. They traveled from Mount Hor along the routes to the Red Sea to go to around Edom. But the people grew impatient on the way. They spoke against God and against Moses and said, "Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the desert? There is no bread, there is no water, and we detest this miserable food." Then the Lord sent venomous snakes among them. They bit the people, and many Israelites died. The people came to Moses and said, "We sinned when we spoke against the Lord and against you. Pray that the Lord will take the snakes away from us." So Moses prayed to the people. The Lord said to Moses, "Make a snake and put it up on a pole. Anyone who is bitten can look at it and live." So Moses made a bronze snake and put it up on a pole. Then anyone who was bitten by a snake and looked at the bronze snake, he lived. The Israelites moved on and camped at Obot. Then they set out from Obot and camped at E-Abrim, in the desert that faces Moab toward the sunrise. From there they moved on and camped in the Zered Valley. They set out from there and camped alongside the Arnon, which is in the desert extending into Amorite territory. The Arnon is the border of Moab between Moab and the Amorites. That is why the Book of the Wars of the Lord says, "Waheb and Suphah and the ravines, the Arnon and the slopes of the ravines, that lead to the site of Ar and lie along the border of Moab." From there, they continued on to Beer, the well where the Lord said to Moses, "Gather the people together and I will give them water." Then Israel sang this song, "Spring up, O well, sing about it, about the well that the princes dug, that the nobles of the people sank, the nobles with scepters and staffs." Then they went from the desert of Matanah, from Matanah to Nahalil, from Nahalil to Bamot, and from Bamot to the valley of Moab, where the top of the Pisgah overlooks the wasteland. Israel sent messengers to say to Sihon, king of the Amorites, "Let us pass through your country. We will not turn aside to any field or vineyard or drink water from any well. We will travel along the king's highway till we have passed through your territory." But Sihon would not let Israel pass through his territory. He mustered his entire army and marched out to the desert against Israel. When he reached Jahaz, he fought with Israel. Israel, however, put him to the sword and took over his land from the Arnon to the Jabbok, and as far as the Ammonites, because their border was forfeited. Israel captured all the cities of the Amorites and occupied them, including Heshbon and all its surrounding settlements. Heshbon was the city of Sihon, king of the Amorites, who had fought against the former king of Moab and had taken from him all his land as far as the Arnon. That is why the poets say, "Come to Heshbon and let it be rebuilt. Let Sihon's city be restored." Fire went out from Heshbon, a blaze from the city of Sihon. It consumed Ar of Moab, the citizens of Arnon's heights. "Woe to you, O Moab! You are destroyed, O people of Chemosh. He has given up his sons as fugitives and his daughters as captives to Sihon, king of the Amorites. But we have overthrown them. Heshbon is destroyed all the way to Dibon. We have demolished them as far as Nophah, which extends to Medeba." So Israel settled in the land of the Amorites. After Moses sent spies to Jazer, the Israelites captured its surrounding settlements and drove out the Amorites who were there. Then they turned and went up along the road toward Bashan. And Og, king of Bashan, and his entire army marched out to meet them in the battle of Edrei. The Lord said to Moses, "Do not be afraid of him, for I have handed him over to you with his whole army and his land. Do to him what you did to Sihon, king of the Amorites, who reigned in Heshbon." So they struck him down together with his sons and his whole army, leaving them no survivors. And they took possession of his land. Okay, any thoughts? Any questions?
Verse 8. "And the Lord said unto Moses, make them a fiery serpent."
Fiery.
Well, the whole verse.
Yes, I understand that, but it's interesting that the word is fiery, mm-hmm. not just a serpent. But one that, yes.
Well, I have here seraph or winged, that there is some thought that this fiery serpent was actually a dragon snake that is extinct now.
Okay.
I have, they're so termed because of their poisonous venom, and a lot of times, not always, snakes that are venomous will have the color red on them, but not always.
Interesting way of looking at things. Any other comments?
All red.
Yeah.
Some red on
a little red. Mm-hmm.
We'll get to there. Okay, so basically the center in this particular subject matter is about this snake being put up on the pole. We'll get you there. Before we get you there, I want you to put your focus in on a few other things. You remember what I mentioned last week? That the wording is beginning to change. Where the wording is now, Israel goes to God, not Moses. You see the transitions taking place. Aaron has passed away. Miriam has passed away. I've said, and I try to be very clear here if I can clarify myself one more time. The book of Numbers is not written in chronological order. And now we have to kind of look at that and say, okay, put that and put us into our mind. Because this chapter, when it's finished, goes into another one. And it's called the Book of Balaam. Now, Moses didn't write the Book of Balaam. And Daniel, when he gets into that section, he will, not that section, but when he goes into his presentation in the future, he'll talk about Balaam. Not today. Just give you a little fear. He's going to be heading that direction because it's going to be something that you would never found out what the conversation was unless Balaam wrote it down. Because Moses didn't have it. Joshua didn't have it. None of the prophets had it. The only person had it would be Balaam. And here we see it coming in after this chapter. So we see here, and we have to be kind of careful of what we're looking at. So we have the person or the body of men called the Great Assembly. When they conglomerated or put together, when they saw an event that was in that general period of time of Israel's history, they then therefore put that event into that section, like here in the book of Numbers. The very first verse. "When the king of Arad, the Canaanite, who dwelt in the south, heard that Israel was coming on the road to Atarim, when he fought against Israel and took some of them prisoners." Okay. What happened here? It says, so Israel, not Moses. Israel made a vow. Now listen very carefully to the grammar here. You can picture it. When it's very typical when you're looking at the word Elohim, that's referring to the creator of heaven and earth. Why? The verb that follows is a singular verb and not a plural verb. And any preposition associated with that one is a singular preposition and not a plural preposition. So we're looking here that it is not Moses who made the vow. It was Israel. Now, when did Israel make that vow? Okay, the author the men who assembled this thing together is bringing us to a point in time now where there's going to be a vow, and the vow is this. So Israel made a vow to the Eternal and said, if you will indeed deliver this people into my hand, then I will utterly destroy their city. And God listened to the voice of Israel and delivered the Canaanites, and they utterly destroyed them and their cities. So the name of the place was called what? Horoth. That took place in the book of Judges. All right? Took place after they entered into the land and Moses wasn't there. So we have to come. And you're doing a lot of scholarly work. You see these words and you're saying, why is this inserted at this particular point in time? The author's going to lead us to a point, or bring us to a point of, we're going to flip some events here that's going to lead us up to something. And what is it going to lead us up to? Well, we'll have to find out. Every time we go back here, I remember I said in the 19th verse of the previous chapter, so the children of Israel said to him, not Moses, didn't say to the king of Elam, the children of Israel said to him, we will do this and we will do that. Remember, the name of Israel now becoming a name, a thing. Like the United States is in North America. Right? We don't say the United States, plural, are in North America.
We used to.
But now it's a unity of one. Do you understand what I'm saying here? So we're looking at this, the verbs being changed here. Israel, verse 2, made a vow to the Lord and said, if you will indeed deliver this people into my hand, not our hands, but my hand, then I, not we, will utterly destroy their cities. Israel at this point in time is a unity of one. And this is what the author is trying to tell us. At one time, Israel was one, Echad. Like God is Echad. Do you understand what I'm saying so far? Because you have to look at the grammar. And the reason why it's important to look at the grammar, because we're going to be introducing pretty quick, or this is going to lead us into the very next book, which is the book of Deuteronomy, which has got a very fantastic historical background on it. Yes, Carmel. Yes, I'll put your name over there.
So you're saying that this Moshe is already dead here?
Just that first section.
We're talking just the first few verses there.
Oh, okay.
What I'm saying, because the book of Judges tells you when that took place. Now, book of Judges came after Joshua died.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the author is not telling us chronological events. This was very important, the book of Numbers.
But
you don't buy chronological events, huh?
Okay, but how can it not be chronological? Verse 4 says, it's talking about the people spoke against God and against Moshe.
Different situation. There is, in Hebrew writing, there is a definite separation of the style of writing that is now abruptly from verse 3 to verse 4. Hebraic writing is quite different between those two verses.
Okay.
It's one of those things you have to kind of know. It's 1 to 3.
Talk about Moshe.
Correct.
Okay.
This is quite common. What the author is trying to do, or not the authors, but whoever wrote this section, what happened? The men of the great assembly put it not a chronological order, but in an event. This event, and that one's related. put them together. This event and that event are related. Put them together. So you have a picture of what the men of the Great Assembly were trying to show us. All right? I do not believe that it's out of order. I believe it's put in order because the men of the Great Assembly were commanded to do that. And they did it. So what it says, and the Canaanites of the south. Now, who's the south? It's the Negev. We're talking Israel. Now, in the book of Judges, the first chapter, yes.
I was going to say that by using that methodology, it gives you multiple witnesses of the same incidents from different perspectives.
Correct.
In most of the Bible, it uses more than one witness to prove something. Well, when you have Balaam's story and whatnot, it talks about, well, this is what Balaam's perspective was of these events. Well, you already have intermingled in here Israel's perspective of the same events, and in some cases, Moses' perspective of the same events. You have three different viewpoints of the same thing happening, all giving you slightly different information.
Does that make sense, what he's saying? Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's like the Gospels give you three.
That's right.
Exactly.
The same.
They're not necessarily always in numerical order or chronological order.
And they don't always use the same verbiage either.
Correct. So
some will remember something else.
And so sometimes when you look at the book of Numbers are probably more noticeable than any of the other books other than Genesis. I mean, Genesis is full of an awful lot of different authors and witnesses. But nonetheless, as far as this particular point in time, we're seeing that there are different points of view. Yes. All bundled together in a package deal. And we have to see the events that are taking place to say, what is it telling us? And Daniel did a real good explanation there. That's how he had to go look at this word. It doesn't mean that there was a mistake. It means it was set in order for us to see what God wants us to be aware of. Yes, Jeff.
Which is indeed what you see at the introduction of the book of Luke. Is that he set things in order.
Correct. It's a very interesting statement with the book of Luke. Okay. Luke was talking, by the way. But I got to say this. That's a key statement that Luke was made. Very important statement he made. And who was he writing to? His best friend, who already knew the facts and the information. He didn't know the order. And all Luke did was straighten out the order. For his Greek friend. Okay, now, then we come into the next section of verse 4 and verse 5. What does it say? Now, he read an interesting interpretation of the words, because sometimes when the interpretation of the word bread, they interpret in his particular translation as food, right? But what does it really say?
Lachem.
Now, we go on to the next one, and the very latter part of it, it says, and our souls do what? Loathe the worthless lachem. What was the worthless, tasteless, horrible eating of the, what was the manna. That manna, it didn't taste like it was the best tasting stuff on the face of the earth. You were, quote, stuck with it, in a quote. Okay, 40 years, you know, they're ready to enter the promised land here. All right, and so now you get the real tastiness of the manna. Now, sometimes we have this thing, the manna of God was beautiful. He sent down manna, and the people did because they had this wonderful manna. And here we have witnesses, they didn't like it. It didn't taste good.
Tired
of it.
Even if it did taste good, they're probably tired of it.
I mean, you get, after a while, Listen, they want real bread here. They want stuff made out of real stuff, And what did God do? Sent some snakes.
He didn't like complaints.
Doesn't like complaints. He sent a bunch of snakes. Now why? Why didn't he send? Why didn't he send a plague? Oh, he sent a plague before, right?
Probably wasn't as drastic a sin as the plague would require. But he did want them to know that he did not like their complaining.
He also is going to remind them of the issue about sin, because the sin of the world would be hung on a pole someday. And maybe he was reminding himself that that sin is going to be erased someday when it is hung on a pole and the Messiah is on a pole.
All right, we'll go there in just a minute.
Also, the snakes were biting, and they were venomous.
Yeah.
And
oh,
that's
yeah.
what our words can be
yeah.
claiming are probably
God. So we got that good picture about snakes, right? You know, okay. And then he made an image, and he put this fiery, or they said red. I don't know. I have to look at it in Hebrew. I thought it was always fiery. But anyway, it's a different. It's not an ordinary snake. You think like a rattlesnake, and it was something. And like Ellie said, there is in the translation that it could be a winged serpent. Do you know what the symbol of Mexico is? The winged serpent.
Well, an eagle with a snake in its mouth.
The Quetzalcoatl. Okay. And so what we're looking at, you know, is that they probably were very, probably the species long since been, you know, extinct. But, you know, once again, you start looking at these things, it's okay, they did exist. We can't picture them ever existing. But, you know, Bible talks about it, so do we believe it is? Well, no, Bible got it wrong because the evolutionary process didn't have those things. Well, that's not necessarily always true. Anyway. Now, as we look at this, we know it relates to something. Now, they lift up the snake made of bronze, and anyone who was bitten by the snake was healed. Right? Now, if you had a disease that was not brought about by the snake, were you healed?
I'll try it.
The answer was no. And only if you're bitten by the snake. All right. What's the symbolism of this? We know that the serpent was at the beginning. What was the bite of the serpent?
Sin.
Yeah.
Trickery. Seduction.
Deception. Ah, just plain old deception, which is deadly. Now, when the serpent has been raised up, this fiery serpent raised up, or this winged serpent was raised up, what is it going to tell us? Or what, if you were there, what would it tell you about? Because they weren't dumb. They weren't ignorant. They knew their history. They knew the history of the Garden of Eden. They knew what took place. They weren't fighting with evolutionary concepts. They weren't fighting with a bunch of people who had PhDs behind them that were smarter than them. They understood. They didn't have a lot of things to unlearn. All right? And to let you know this for sure, and we had done it before. Remember when Moses said to God, I have to know what your name is. If I don't know your name, they will not believe me. And so he told them his name, and then he went and he said, the name, and the people, the leader said, okay, well, we recognize the name, you know. Then we know who you're talking about, who you're talking about. Sometimes we think that the quote, slaves were a bunch of idiots, never educated, didn't know how to read or write, but that's nothing there in Torah that says they didn't know how to read and write. They were very intelligent people, like you are. They could think and act. All right, so it brings us up to, of course, John. I have to go there. Sorry there. Because, see, now along comes Messiah, and he said something. And he said what there in John 3rd chapter? I'll read it so you can do it while you turn there. And as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. Wow. Mm-hmm. And whoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life. Now, what's the connection? Why did he do this? Why did he say that? Any idea?
Seems to be a lot of parallels in the word that all point to Messiah.
Okay. What?
He's reversing the damage. The Messiah reverses the damage that the serpent did in the Garden of Eden.
Okay.
You
got to
think of who was Jesus talking to?
Okay, here you go. You get, who was Jesus talking to?
Nicodemus.
All right, fascinating thing. It's just not a statement that'd be made. You got to say, why did he say this to Nicodemus? And why did John decide, hey, that's a cool statement, I'm going to write it down? Isn't that fascinating? You got to think about this for a while, don't you? It's an interesting thought. Yes.
Going back to our discussion about the serpent in Genesis chapter 3, one of the fun things that comes out of that is discovering what the play on words there between nakedness and serpent, and the fact that the serpent, the word there ends up being conveying a sense of cunning, yet its deeds being open and exposed. So perhaps there is a connection there between the deeds of the adversary being exposed and the deeds of Messiah being exposed for what they are.
Or you who do not know what he's referring to, there's a key central word that connects let's go back to Genesis. You got me off on another chapter. It's all your fault. You know, I'm going to do that to you when you're up here.
Yeah,
Genesis. It's a very interesting statement. We know this. In the very last verse of chapter 2, and the last two verses, the man and the woman shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall be one. And they were both naked, and the man and the wife were not ashamed. To play on words here now. Now the key word is the serpent was more naked than any beast of the field. You see, we look at that and we can't translate that in Hebrew into English. That doesn't make sense. He must have been more cunning. He was smarter. He was clever.
Does that mean uncovered?
Uncovered. Naked.
Vulnerable.
Exposed.
Vulnerable.
Vulnerable. Now, it's a play on words to understand how you join chapter 2 and chapter 3 together and the conclusion why they were thrown out of the Garden of Eden. But just to understand what you see in the picture there, what he was trying to is the vulnerability of the Messiah. And I think that's what you're trying to say. Is that right, Jeff? Vulnerability of the Messiah, like the vulnerability of the naked snake, is because exposed. Exposure. Okay? It's an interesting approach. I don't have anything to disagree with that. But you'll learn things that is fascinating in Hebrew and why and throughout the entire, most of you know this, but throughout the entire, especially in the book of Genesis, there's so many plays on words from here to there to here to there, that if you don't catch it, you can miss it. And that's one of those that I had teased. Actually, I'd given him an assignment, and he failed it. And so, I was just one of the fun things I do to people when I want to it. Let's go back here now to John, third chapter here now, so we can have a little picture of who he's talking to. Now, here in Nicodemus, you're fully aware of the story. You're also fully aware of the purpose of the destruction of this serpent that Moses made during the time of what king?
Hezekiah.
Right. Hezekiah, the king of Hezekiah, is a beginning of the focal point. Well, we won't go there today. Daniel will probably get to that one this time. It's the focal point of the events that were going to transpire to shape the entire nation. we have here where Nicodemus said to him, verse 4, about how can a man be born when he is old? How can he be in the second time in his mother's womb and be born? And Jesus most assuredly said to you, unless you are born of water and spirit, and he cannot enter into the kingdom of God. Okay, now we're focusing in on the kingdom of God. And then which is born of flesh is flesh, that which is born of spirit is spirit. Do not marvel that I say to you, you must be born again. And he said, now I tell you, the wind comes and goes where it wants. And Nicodemus answered, verse 9, and said to him, how can this be? How is that going to happen? That's a legitimate question, right? How is that going to happen? How am I going to go from this form into a form that's like the wind? That's a legitimate question, right? If you were there, would you ask that question? Well, you know, the person you ask says, what? You a teacher? You don't know what the answer is? That's a pretty tough statement he made back at him. But nonetheless, we have to read it. And he says, are you a teacher of Israel and you not know these things? Don't you understand what's all about? You know, pretty heavy insult, you might say. And so he goes on, and he says now, most certainly I say to you, we speak what we know and testify what we have seen, and you do not receive our witnesses. If I had told you earthly things, you would not, earthly things, and you do not believe. How much do you believe if I tell you heavenly things? And no one has ascended into heaven but he who has come down from heaven, and that is the Son of Man. And as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. So, if I tell you earthly things to explain the spiritual things, all right, that's what his statement was, right? If I have told you earthly things and you do not believe, the serpent was lifted up as an earthly thing, all right, so will the Son of Man be lifted up. What happened? What was the image of the serpent? What was he lifted up on? Lifted up on a pole. So it meant the death of the deceiver, the winged serpent.
Just to jog my memory. The Hebrew word for pole there means standard, or like a memorial something or other. I forget what.
Correct.
So it means that basically that the serpent was sitting on something that was meant to signify something else.
Signify something else. The pole is the issue, not the serpent. In Christianity, we think of what? The cross. But signifies a symbol of something. What does it signify the symbol of?
Death.
That's what it symbolizes. So we have an image of the cross, and it symbolizes death, not life. And yet, what is it supposed to tell us? That the Son of Man was going to be put to death. All right? So he comes back in here, and we'll keep on going this one. But then he goes on. This is the most famous chapter. For God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten Son, who was to believe by him should not perish, but have everlasting life. We know now that the symbolism was a representation of the destruction of the Messiah as the pole, or that symbol of the serpent being lifted on a pole, was a symbol of the execution of deception. Does that make sense to you? Now, what did Jesus die from? I'm sorry, what?
A broken heart.
Okay. He died of a broken heart. And what does that mean? Not in our human emotional feeling. What does that mean scripturally?
That
What is the heart in the biblical terminology? What does it represent?
Our mind, our soul.
Spirit. You must love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your soul. Okay. The heart is a governing seat of everything you do. The reason why you do what you do is because, quote, your heart is there. Where your treasure is, there is your soul? No, your heart. Okay, so everything is governed around that particular statement. So when we say he died of a broken heart, don't think of heart failure or a heartache. Think of something else. What was his heart centered in on?
Kingdom of God. Father.
He was separated from the Father.
So that everyone, see, this is the condemnation, verse 19, of the light that came into the world, and the men who loved darkness were the light because their deeds were evil. For everyone practices evil, hates light, and does not come down to the light, lest his deeds should be exposed. But he who does the truth comes to the light, that his deeds may be clearly seen, that they may be correct. Or done in God. What does that refer to? Now, so we look at the dying of a broken heart means what? What was his purpose of coming?
To bring light to the world.
To bring light to the world. And the world did what with light?
They didn't like it.
And they put it out.
They put it out.
They put it out. But not for long. You know, 3 days later it came back.
Bigger.
It came back bigger because it has to do with the first book of John. We won't go there today. I mean, John, first chapter, and then it says the light could not comprehend it. Means the light could not overcome it. The light could not stop it. The light could not prevent it from happening when the light came. But we won't go there today. We got back to Numbers. We're getting off on our tangent here. I'm going too far. Okay, now we go into the latter part of this, and there's some songs out there. I don't know exactly what translations you people have. Everybody has a different kind of translation. But it says there, verse 14 of Numbers, the 21st chapter. Read Numbers 14, first part. The 14th verse of that chapter.
Therefore, it is said in the book of the wars of the Lord.
Stop. What? What? We miss a book? Do we lose a book?
Chronicles?
Where did we go? But the scrolls are missing. Where's the war? Where's the wars of the Lord? Where are they recorded at?
Joshua and Judges?
Huh?
Joshua and Judges? Those are wars.
Joshua and Judges. They're written in the book of Joshua and Judges. They're written in the book of the Lord. The wars that are constantly going on in all of the book, especially Joshua and the book of Judges, constant wars. And it took how many years for them to finally get together and become one nation? Over 400 years. It's a long time. And all you see is wars. God, war. They're asking for help. God, war. They ask for help. God, war. They ask for help. God, war. You want to know what the wars of God are all about? Joshua and Judges. I'll tell you, the wars that God fights. And when you read some of these names of the praises of Aron and of the book of Moab and Ar, you'll find them written in the book of Joshua and the book of Judges. So the book's not missing. It's just that if you want to know what the wars are, they're there. Now, in some of your translations, the very first word has Wahib in Shufa, or Sufa. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's nothing more than the Red Sea. That's the word for Red Sea. Mm-hmm. All right, so if you're curious. So we're going back in time. It says, one of the lords of God is what? The Red Sea. Now, wait a minute. They already passed that, didn't they? Yes. Where's the war about the Red Sea? Well, it must be written someplace. You know, so we see a picture here. If you want to know what God's wars are all about, you can go back to Exodus and find out what the war was all about. This, we're telling you, this is how God fights for Israel. Even though Israel doesn't deserve it, he fights for Israel. Why would he fight for Israel? Because he made a promise unto Abraham. David. Oh. Wrap it up quick. Any more questions? Do you understand what I'm trying to drive at? We're looking at not a mystery thing of things like that, but we're leading into the part. We're going to go to verse 21. Israel sent message to Shihoh, the king of Ammon, saying, now remember, it's Israel who's asking, who's sending the message, not Moses. So we got a story of all the wars regarding here. We starting with in the book of the 20th chapter, verse 14 down to probably verse 18 about a conflict with the nation around Israel. And then we have more conflict with the nation in the south land, the Negev. And then we have a bunch of names of wars being handled here in the 14th verse and 15th verse and 16th and 17th verse and so on and so forth and more praises. Now we're looking here now, the authors are putting together some events of what? The wars of the Lord. And it's going to lead us into the war with Barak. Before we get there, did Barak win? Why didn't he win? Well, we'll get there. Yes, Jeff.
Something to address next week would be a question that comes up very often regarding the wars of the Lord is that is God a God of peace or is he a God of war? There are many people who do not see a God of compassion or peace, and all they see is a God of war.
Well,
so
yeah.
They say that this God that we have recorded here is an archaic God from a time before there were peacemakers in the world. So if you could address that next week, that'd be
great. We will. Good one. That's it for me.